Hi, everyone. We are back for another episode of the Houndstooth Center's podcast, Off the Stage. I am Maddie Miller, your host, and I'm the media specialist for the Houndstooth Center. And today we have Christopher McKnight Nichols, a professor of history at Ohio State University, joining us today. Chris, thanks for being here.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We were just talking before the podcast about Ohio, and I know you have not been there for super long, but I have to ask, are you a Buckeyes fan?
Have to be. Definitely am.
To be. It's like a requirement.
It is literally a requirement of my job. Because the chair that I hold is the Wayne Woodrow Hayes chair in National Security Studies, aka Woody Hayes, aka arguably, if not the most famous football coach in U.S. football history.
Sure. I actually just went to an Ohio State game. My dad turned 60 this year, so his big request was to get the whole family to an Ohio State football game. It was a good game to watch, but it was just a blowout. But it's always fun to be in the shoe and watch the games. So
it is amazing to be in there with 110,000 other human beings.
I mean, if you
think about it, just any game. I teach a class on religion and foreign relations. You know, rooting for a team is religious faith. Like you get in there and it's transcendent.
Oh my gosh, yes. And then it's an interesting thing living in Michigan now, being an Ohio State fan. I have a winter hat and I have a few sweatshirts and stuff. Every time I wear them, I get comments like, why are you here? All this stuff. I'm like, I have to stay true to my foundation.
Do you get booed or?
So, yes, especially around the time of the Ohio State Michigan game, Thanksgiving, they're especially ruthless. But you know, the one thing my dad taught us was to always be a Buckeye. So okay. I'm holding.
And you're
fast.
Still flying that flag.
Oh
in
yes,
Michigan. All right.
Very much so. Honestly, it's a sense of pride. I will say it is rough that the 2 years I've lived in Michigan is the 2 years Michigan has won the Ohio State Michigan game. So this year I'm just hoping for a little bit better luck.
Right. I mean, the entire state of Ohio is also rooting along.
Exactly. You know, yeah. So it'll be fun. But anyways, we are excited to have you here today for our event tonight, which we'll talk a little bit more about at the end. But one thing we always do on the podcast is our famous BOQ, which is that little bowl that's sitting next to you, has questions in it. So you can pull. These are questions that were submitted, some via social media, some our staff wrote. So really I'm interested to see what you get.
I'm scrounging around in this pot for those who are listening.
Yeah.
A little mini pot.
So you can read the question and then answer it.
All right. Ooh, okay. What is your greatest accomplishment and how did you achieve it?
That's a deep question.
That's a deep question.
No, normally they're a little bit more light than that.
Yeah,
but
that's serious. You know, I mean, either I'm such a professor or such an odd person, you know, there's so many ways to answer a question you immediately gravitate to professional kinds of accomplishments, but the things that are really lasting in life are not your career. I think that would be my take at least.
I love that.
You know, so in some ways, greatest accomplishment, you know, I think I have an amazing partner, my wife, Lily. You know, it's not an accomplishment it's unfair to say that having an amazing partner is your own accomplishment, but having a thriving relationship that's, you know, meaningful and important and lasts through all kinds of tumultuous things. I mean, I think that been through some tough times. I think that would be probably where I'd land. I could talk about some professional things, but that's where I'd land.
No, I love that. I think that's a great take. And it's true. I think relationships are hard work. I've watched a lot of people in my life struggle through marriages and stuff. So to be able to come out on the other side, that is such an accomplishment.
Yeah. I'm at the age now where a lot of my best friends and I talk about the number of people who have been divorced or have been multiple times, you know, that relationships haven't worked out. Or never found anyone. Some of the most impressive women I know in academics spent their 30s getting PhDs and have some regrets about where their lives have gone personally, even though their professional life is incredibly fulfilling. So there's all kinds of dimensions of that. I mean, as a former Humanities Center director, I'm always thinking about the humanistic components of life accomplishments and also tragedies, you know, coming out on the other end of difficult things.
For sure. I actually have a question later in the podcast about something related to like getting your PhD. So I'm excited to talk about that. But let's do one more BOQ question.
Okay. Hopefully it's not as deep, maybe. Yeah, or maybe no, maybe that's
fun.
The point. I don't
no,
know.
Okay. It really usually they're like fun. So.
Ooh, all right, here we go. Here's one that's more fun. Okay. All right. So if you could communicate with one kind of animal, what would you pick?
I love this question. I will have to just shout out my colleague Abby Sachs. Mm-hmm. She actually came, like, I had just set this equipment up this morning, mm-hmm. and she came in and added that question right in there. Ooh. And she said, I want someone to answer this. Right. So I'm glad you pulled it.
Okay, way to go, Abby. What would you, well, I mean, I'm a total dog person, so I have to say dog.
Yeah.
I can't not.
Do you have a dog?
You know, I don't currently have a dog.
Okay.
I'm a total dog person who doesn't currently have a dog. We just moved, and yeah, I imagine a dog is in the near future.
For sure.
But, you know, in my everyday life, I think the point of the podcast is to be human off the stage.
Yes.
It would have to be a squirrel, because when I'm having coffee in the morning, there's this a million squirrels hanging out outside my house. I see them all the time. They're cute.
Like, yeah.
What are they up to? What mm-hmm. What are their strategies for burying nuts?
Yes.
You know?
Oh, my gosh.
All kinds of things like that.
Allie and I, who's my other colleague, we live in the same neighborhood, and we always used to talk about how, like, the squirrels are just so used to people, so they mm-hmm. don't even, like, run away, like, when I get close to them. I'm always like, are those the same squirrels I'm seeing every day, or are squirrels, like, I would love to also.
Right. Yeah. Is that tree your home? Why do you look a lot like the other ones, or the little ones.
Who's
yeah.
your family?
Yeah, who's
do you
your
hate
family?
Any of the other squirrels? Right. That's a great one. So I would also love to be able to talk to the squirrels for sure. Well, that was great. Those were two good BOQ questions. I always like to then kind of just transition to the podcast, kind of just talk about like your beginnings. So like, where did you grow up? What was your family like? What did you do for fun when you were like in school, and how did that kind of transfer into the rest of your life?
So I grew up, born and raised in New York City.
Okay.
In the actual city.
The
actual city. So
that's
people sometimes say urban places, but they're from quite far in the suburbs.
Yeah.
So the urban people always, we know. so I grew up Upper West Side of Manhattan and the East Side of Manhattan, and went to the same school for 13 years, which was great. The continuity was fantastic. As an aside, it's also where my partner Lily went, but she's 3.5 years younger.
Okay.
And we did not know each other.
Wow.
We never, as far as we know, we never really met and talked in high school, for instance. I was a senior when she was a freshman.
Yeah.
But we definitely overlapped. She knew some of my friend group.
Yeah.
I knew some of hers. And that, so fast forwarding that story slightly, we met in graduate school at the University of Virginia.
I was just
going
to say, where did you guys meet?
Yep.
That's crazy to make that connection.
So a bunch of years later. Yeah, through a mutual friend who had also gone to the same high school. I knew since fourth grade, I was one of those weird people that I wanted to be a historian. So I had a great teacher.
Fourth grade.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, I had a great teacher in fourth grade, ancient Sumeria. She brought in stuff that seemed like the tablets of the oldest recipe known to humankind.
Wow.
I remember it vividly.
Yeah.
And it was just like, this is the kind of thing. I mean, I wound up being a U.S. historian. I do, you know, ideas in U.S. foreign policy and domestic politics. But that was a formative moment. It ignited a passion. You know, and I think, like, for a lot of professors, we're pulled all over the place. Like, teaching is a big part of the calling.
Yeah.
Or should be.
Yeah, for sure.
And so, you know, that's just been at the heart of how I think about my job, even though my job has many other things, administrative component, public events, research writing, all that kind of stuff.
That's awesome. That's so cool to hear. I feel like you don't really hear that many people, like, know their life calling or just something they're interested in that young. So,
And then, I mean, honestly, it's, like, so fortunate to get to pursue that. Mm-hmm. There's a terrible job market for historians or for PhDs in the humanities.
Yeah.
You know, all the steps that get you from having a calling and a passion, you know, I mean, you could think about it. That's a little bit more approachable than, say, wanting to be a professional baseball player, which would have been the other career path that I would have chosen as a fourth grader. But,
yeah. That's awesome. So then to kind of, like, move on then, so you knew you wanted to be a historian. How did you choose what college to go to? What did you get a degree in and all that?
Yeah, so I think the biggest, the most important element, one thing that's funny about choosing colleges, especially now that I've been teaching at universities for a while, is how bad the decision making is from so many people.
Yeah.
And advising friends and friends' kids and stuff. So, like, you know, I often encounter students who chose their college in part because of, like, swag. On the West Coast, where I taught at Oregon State University, it was very common that people wanted to, like, be a Ducks fan or a Beavers fan.
Okay, I see. Like
it was
kind
a
of
family tradition. Yeah, it didn't matter what your major was, or if you're like Corvallis or Eugene. It didn't matter. Just like it had very little to do with school, in other words.
Okay.
So anyway, I think we're all pretty ill-equipped to make those choices. Mm-hmm. So I went off to Harvard at first, and that was solid, but it's not a place that's known for teaching undergrads particularly well, although it has such talented undergrads.
Yeah, I was going to say, I guess I didn't know that. That's
I mean, you get a great education.
I was going to say, I view Harvard as like the elite of the elite.
It's definitely that, but it's not a place where, depending on your major, professors are always in their office hours. You get close mentoring.
Okay.
You know, a small liberal arts school or small major, at least, is much more likely to do that. So just back to the previous point, you know, thinking about teaching, one of the things that I always keep in mind is like, I always keep my office hours. And if there's a reason that I'm not going to be somewhere, all of my students have at least gotten two kinds of communications about my not being present. Because I just think it can be so discouraging to a student, and it was to me at times in college, when somebody didn't show up, you're interested in the or you want to interested in something in the topic, or you wanted clarification, or you just wanted to like talk like we are in some ways, like as human beings and not some. And so so I found a lot more of that, fast forwarding slightly the story, to going to graduate school at the University of Virginia. And, and grad programs are very much more, you know, tailored to those kinds of personal interactions. And that clinched my interest in, you know, at least that kind of mentoring, close mentoring.
Yeah, that's cool. This is the next question I have is the question that I referenced earlier. So I was doing like a bit of research on you just to, you know, prepare for this podcast. And I came across something that I found really interesting, which is on your profile page on Ohio State's website, which has like your office hours and stuff. One of the statements that it said, and I'm just going to read this for the listeners because I won't do a good job summarizing it. It says this. Given the dire state of the U.S. and world academic job markets in history and the humanities, Nichols encourages potential graduate students to take some time to consider whether the pursuit of a doctorate in history is truly best for them. In that light, Nichols is a dedicated advisor and is keenly interested in an honest, open approach to the pros and cons of graduate school and advanced work in history, which is so funny, your reaction to when I started reading that. I'm just interested, like, why is that like a passion for you? And like, why would you just, I don't know, outright state that on your profile page?
So there's two elements to that. One is, I think it's incumbent on all of us who have tenured positions, who are advisors to graduate students, to be really honest about how hard it is to become a professor right now. It was really hard when I was applying for jobs. It's even harder now. Mm-hmm. So everyone coming in needs to know that it's a real long shot. It's a lottery. The best people, you know, there were probably better people applying for lots of the jobs that I got. Who knows how and why I got them or other people get them, right? So you can throw darts at an applicant pool right now and find every time you'll find somebody exceptional. That so I want people thinking about graduate school to think honestly and openly about those realities. But the other piece of it is, you know, like what we're doing here, I'm really dedicated to public history, public humanities, bringing the best insights of research to bear on contemporary questions. That is not limited to the academy. That's not limited to being a professor.
Okay.
So if students want to work with me and think about, you know, how could I be an editor for the Made by History section, now at Time Magazine, which is, I've been on the editorial board of when I was at the Washington Post, or, you know, how can I do more public work of particular types, you know, podcasts. There's a lot of ways that you can monetize that. It's not always going to be a full career, but it might be the kind of thing you most want to do and maybe aren't that interested in so much of the teaching or scholarship. Yeah. Anyway, so I want to have those conversations up front and honestly with students. And then as their interests evolve, think through with them where that might take them. Because I think, you know, another way to think about that in my own career was I wasn't sure I wanted to do so much public work when I first started. Mm-hmm. I wrote a first op-ed and that spiraled to another thing. And then, you know, blogs were still a thing when I was in grad school. So like blogging seemed useful and good. What's the next version of that? So I hope students, you know, people thinking about graduate school are thinking about those future kind of technological innovations and other ways to bring the best insights of humanities, history, liberal arts, political science to wider audiences. And, you know, I think we'll be talking about tonight in the event, and so much of the Hauenstein Center's programming involves this stuff. You know, if we don't do that, we're in a lot of trouble in the U.S., in the world. I mean, we are not thinking clearly and planning for the future in ways that we really should.
Yeah, that's so true. So what would you, like, what do those conversations look like? Are you looking for, like, more, like, personality wise, or are you looking more at like their passions and like, I don't know, what, yeah. What do you look for in someone who you would really encourage mm-hmm. to go that route versus maybe like steer them in a different direction?
Well, I think it's definitely the passions, right? Okay. So like, I'm really passionate about history. Love it. Love my subjects. That has to guide you because you do this for so long,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
If you're not passionate, years. Like you will yeah. just collapse. Like it won't, mm-hmm. it won't keep being good and certainly mm-hmm. won't be fulfilling. Another element of that, I think, is, you know, where I started with like being honest about what's possible in the job okay. and what isn't. You know, it's yeah. the graduate students don't get paid well. Mm-hmm. They aren't always treated well. They should be paid better and treated better, yeah. in my view. But you know, these are structural things we can only advocate so much for.
Yeah.
And then thinking kind of long term about what will be fulfilling. I think as I've gone through my career, I think a lot more, and I advise people applying, like, where would you like to live? You know, we start saying, like, moving from Ohio to Michigan.
Yeah.
What kind of life can you imagine in that mm-hmm. place? Because you're not just studying. You know, for my answer to the accomplishment thing, you're not yeah. just, you're not simply a student or a scholar or whatever. You're a human being living in a place. Like, will it be fulfilling there?
Yeah, that's so true. That's great. I was, like, even just thinking about, like, this is my story on like such a smaller scale, but like right out of undergrad, I had no idea what I wanted to do. So I just decided to go to grad school. Like
yep.
just, it picked kind of more of a random thing. And I ended up dropping out of my program because I was like, actually, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this even long term, like mm-hmm. whatever. And I remember people being like, oh, like you're just going to quit. And I'm like, yeah, because I know I'm not passionate about it. And then I ended up in this job and I mm-hmm. love it. I love doing this kind of stuff. So like, I know it was in the end a good choice for me, but sometimes like schooling just seems like the next step.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, it's so often like a default step, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's
yes,
or, I mean,
exactly.
especially for history students, it's
yeah.
law school is.
Yeah.
Like 33% of my students, or at least easily, sometimes it feels like it's even more going off to law school just because
yeah.
it seems like it's a knowable career path. It's more school. They've done well in school, that kind of thing. You know, the other thing I think is, like, I love your example. You know, sometimes we need to quit. Like, sometimes we know best, right? Trust
yeah.
your gut.
Mm-hmm.
And I say this about research projects too. Like, sometimes you know, even if it seems fruitful, like it may not be the one for you. And if
yeah.
if you feel in your gut, this isn't for me, then get away from it.
Yeah.
Right. Whether
yeah.
it's school or other things. Now then there's the financial questions, right? So
exactly.
school and taking on debt, you
yep.
know, so that's the other advice I always give folks, like when I'm mentoring, you know,
yeah.
don't, especially for a PhD in the humanities, do not take on debt. It's a terrible
mm-hmm.
bet. I worked a little bit in banking, actually, earlier
oh,
in my career
okay.
or before going to grad school. And you know, I think I often think about, you know, just how bad of a bargain it is to get take on debt for college and then for graduate programs.
Yeah.
It's so hard. I mean, you need to have such
for
a
sure.
high salary rapidly so that you
to
can
be
live
able
your life.
To yeah, pay that off.
Yeah.
Oh, that's insane. Yeah, that's really great. That's cool that you are focused on, like, thinking about that and whatnot. My next question for you is something, so when I was doing my little research on you, I saw that you've done a lot of speaking engagements, a lot of different talks or panels or whatever it is, and I was wondering just about that, like, public speaking piece, like, how do you feel like you've always been a good public speaker, or how did you become better at it, and, like, what advice would you give for someone wanting to be a better public speaker? And I'm selfishly asking this because I want to become a better public speaker. Like, sometimes even if I'm, like, attending an event and I'm asking a question in the audience, I'll get so nervous just to ask a question in front of an audience, much less, like, be able to talk. So I guess I'm just curious about that.
I mean, the number one way to do it is practice.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I was like, I knew he was going to
yeah,
say
I
that.
I mean, it's so, I certainly was not as good as I am now at any other stage of my life or career.
Yeah.
So that a lot of that is practice. It's knowing your subjects.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of ways in which you can model good performing, you know, and can think about, you know, what are the kinds of speakers you most like? You know, what do you want to emulate? What would you want to reject?
Yeah.
Taping yourself is a really good technique. All teaching.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like a lot of teaching centers will tape you teaching, but you can do the same thing with, you know, giving a public talk or even in Q&A if the camera goes to you, and think about, you know, what were your hands doing, how
yeah.
were your lips moving.
Yep.
And then, of course, you're going to find all kinds of faults and flaws. If I find it really, really hard to watch myself sometimes.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I know that to get better, I need to do it.
For sure.
Or you find that you're saying, I don't know if we'll see when we listen to this, are there a lot of ums in our conversation?
Yeah, that's one thing I was going to bring up. Like, I notice that sometimes, like, or even I do a lot of podcasts, so I feel like I'm better at that. But, like, public speaking, you know, kind of not speaking from a script, I'm always doing ums and uhs and, like, little filler noises.
What's interesting about that, doing so many events in the last, in recent years, is audiences often like the unscripted and slow, a little bit slower or more gradual kind of build up.
Yeah.
And, but that comes at the cost of ums and uhs and, and like tangents and logical problems and things like that. I think that another piece of speaking, there are speaking coaches. You can go another level.
We have like a coaching thing that we're kind of partners with that we sometimes let our students do, which is called Speak Up and Be Effective. And it's like a public speaking course or whatever, and our students love to do that.
Yeah, so. I think the hardest thing is big audiences, potentially. Yeah. There is a level of fear or, you know, stress. And that can, either you can rise to the occasion and do great, or begin to
no. Yeah, stutter or whatever.
Yeah, so, and that's another one where experience helps. Yeah. So, you know, I would say for people who are nervous but who can get it done, they should always, you know, grasp onto any opportunity to do some of it.
That's good advice. My next question.
Oh, I got one more.
Oh, yes.
So, I think, so this is what I often do this. I did this before what we're doing today.
Okay.
Just in case, it hasn't happened to me in years, but just in case you get a little nervous, have some scripted material even when you're unscripted.
Okay.
So act like you're unscripted.
Yes.
But you bring, I have my briefcase over here. You bring some stuff so that, okay, I want to get back on track. So-and-so, so we're doing a moderator panel, and I'm moderating, and I'm a panelist.
Yeah.
So-and-so said something, got us way off track. You know, I have three or four sentences scripted to help us get back on.
Yeah.
I can turn to that. It's both a like an act as a speaker that, you know, right, to look, you look professional. Everybody's eyes will be on you. But you've written it out. So in that moment, you don't have to stress about what you're going to say.
Okay.
And you know it's a segue to something else.
Yeah, that is good. I mean, I feel that way, like, even just with my podcast notes. Like, I have questions written out here, but sometimes I'll even write out, like, in my own voice how I want to ask a question. Or sometimes I'll just write the question and I'm just asking you it. So it's good to kind of have those.
But you're doing, like, I would say you're doing it exactly right, in the sense that, like, we make a lot of eye contact. Like, you're not, you're not looking at the page or the script. The other, that's the other disaster, really. You have, you know, it's
like,
really hard to energize an audience, or even just when you're having a two-person conversation, if you're mostly looking at a screen or a script.
Yeah.
If you go to, like, a professional association for many scholars, we're still reading from paper, right?
Yeah.
And going slowly through paper, or going really fast because they wrote too much.
Yeah.
And that's just, it's a recipe for a less engaging talk, no matter how brilliant it is.
Yeah, for sure.
So when I was running this Humanities Center, we often would do these, like, sort of lightning round panels where you couldn't really rely on those scripts. Like, you get 5 minutes to say one, you know, thought-provoking thing, and then we move on to Q&A.
Yeah.
And that worked really well. Like, audiences really like that, and sharp people doing their research can distill down into a quick set of remarks
for sure.
Make eye contact and talk like a normal person.
Yeah, I feel like at our events sometimes I feel that way too. Like, I think the keynote, you know, is always good and whatever, but I feel like sometimes the most engaging thing is the audience questions, because that's not the scripted part of the event.
Yeah.
It's kind of when the speaker has to kind of just rely on their expertise, but also just rely on their human skills to communicate their idea. And I always really like that.
Although the downside of live audience Q&A is it can be disastrous, you know, where people have a comment masquerading as a question or say something really offensive.
Yeah.
It's only happened to me a few times, but it's, you know, a really difficult situation every once in a while.
I've been at the Hauenstein Center for a year and a half, and we've had some audience questions where we're kind of like, oh, that was a little, but I've never had something like big crazy happen, so, which I'm crossing my fingers and knocking on wood here.
You stay that lucky forever. May the whole center. It just takes one. And then the other thing is it derails a great event.
Like, exactly.
Everything that came before and everything that comes after is
not memorable.
Nobody
will be able to think about.
Yeah, it's really, it's really hard to do.
Yeah,
to deal
I agree.
With.
My next question for you is, so the Hauenstein Center, we're doing a theme for our programming this year, and the theme is empowered citizenship. And we were kind of thoughtful in that way of doing empowered citizenship to, like, prep for an election year next year, which has been just been able to open up a lot of cool conversations with our speakers, or how each event ties into that theme, you know, even talking to our students and our Cook Leadership Academy about that, whatever. So I'd just be curious to hear from you. What do you think it means to be an empowered citizen?
Wow. Yeah, a lot of things. There's a ton going on in the empowered part and the citizen part.
Exactly.
So rewinding slightly, when I was teaching on the West Coast, I started a series of programs under the title Citizenship and Crisis.
Okay.
And they wound up going very well and moving throughout the Pacific Northwest. So we did community conversations about citizenship and crisis in big cities like Portland and small towns and Eastern Oregon, which is very conservative, and Western in the Willamette, which is very liberal.
Okay.
A lot like what you all do.
Yeah.
And, you know, what was interesting to me was how many different perspectives people brought to bear on what is citizenship.
Yeah.
You know, like, what does it count? Is it an offensive term? So in some migrant communities and in some immigrant communities, and even for quite a few scholars, citizenship is really loaded and negative. And then for some folks, they don't see any concerns whatsoever about the concept of citizenship, and there the blinders are obvious. So, you know, for me, one element of empowered citizenship is both within your rights, being able to advocate for whatever you want without fear of significant blowback.
For sure.
So empowered citizenship in the U.S., you know, is something like being able to protest at a state capitol without fear. Or sign ballot initiatives or advance them, you know, to actually advance issues and that you care about, whether or not, frankly, you're a citizen. So the other thing there is what I used to sometimes propose to audiences is that instead of citizen, what if we talk about an engaged member of the community, right?
Okay.
So you don't actually have to have U.S. citizenship to be an engaged member of the community.
Yeah.
And as such, empowered engaged members of the community could be, you know, new migrants, they could be grandparents helping take care of kids, they could be, you know, from another country or any of or children under 18, you know, who don't have full voting rights, a lot of those elements. So there's a lot to say there. And then since we're talking global citizenship tonight, empowered citizenship in a world context means thinking outside of the nation state, right? So it's very easy for Americans, especially of all countries, to be parochial and think the U.S. is the greatest, and or to prioritize just American interests, even if they don't necessarily think in exceptionalist terms.
Yep.
And so the idea of an empowered citizen who's thinking globally is something that totally resonates with younger generations. If you look at polling data, it's like very true.
Yeah.
And that's something we'll be talking about again tonight, but that strikes me all the time in my teaching that, you know, we have these competing priorities for what the U.S. should do, what the world should do. Mm-hmm. Empowered citizens who are under 30 want to deal with climate change, want to deal with future questions, and questions of inequality, for instance, where we're talking about student debt. There's some things that matter a lot more to younger Americans in particular, but younger people around the world.
Yeah.
And yet their versions of empowered citizenship haven't generated the meaningful outcomes that they want. So like, what's thwarting that? Another way to think about that is, you know, why aren't there more empowered citizens achieving what they aim for, especially when there's the clear majorities, at least, of under 30 people.
Yeah.
And then the corollary question, which I'm always perplexed by, is why isn't that generational group vote more?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because they're equal or greater. They're about to be greater than the boomer generation, mm-hmm. and yet they vote in much lower percentages. Now, we could quibble with that all day. It could be a whole nother podcast. But, you know, basically, if you take voting as just one measure, but it's the most obvious measure of, like, what an empowered citizen can and should do, and that requires citizenship.
Yeah.
You know, go out and vote.
Yeah.
The other problems are structural. Why don't we have a holiday for voting? You know, why don't you get paid on that holiday?
Yeah.
There's a lot of ways to make that easier, and both parties in the U.S. are not incentivized to do that. But particularly, the Republican Party is against expanding the franchise and those kinds of things that Northern European countries, for instance, do, and they get enormous numbers of people out voting, which seems like the basic prerequisite for a functioning democracy.
For every citizen.
Yeah. And they often tie it to rights and responsibilities. So if you don't vote in 3 out of 4 elections, you get less in terms of the social safety net and other things. Or if you want to drive, you know, a driver's license requires voter registration. There's a handful of so there's a lot of obvious answers. Political scientists, social scientists.
Yeah. You
know, like if we could all wave a magic wand, you could figure out how to get more citizens at least empowered through the voting system. I think the other ways of empowerment are just as important: community activism, right, engagement with civic society, and all kinds of other individuals. Like, the things that we do on a local level are more impactful in many ways. But if you don't think nationally and globally, we're going to miss a whole lot.
Yeah, that's good. You hit on so many good points, but it made me think a lot about our first event of this semester was called Citizenship in Crisis, which is funny that you said kind of the same thing, but that was the title of the event, and we had two people on stage, Victor Davis Hanson and Eric Liu. I don't know if you're familiar with either, but they both said, you know, great things on different sides of the aisle. But one thing that I really appreciated was Eric Liu talking about that need for, you know, to be an empowered citizen is to be involved in your communities and be involved in things. And, you know, it's not just voting. It's more like being, yeah, exactly what you just said, being involved and stuff like that. So
yeah, I think love there's that. Surveys that suggest that people feel like they feel more empowered when they do those kinds of actions locally. Yep. And then there's the next steps, right?
Bigger.
It gets bigger and bigger, right?
Exactly.
I think that's true for a lot of us. If you think about how you get engaged, like with college, or we're talking about office hours, right?
Yeah,
if you start
yeah.
going to office hours, you will probably be a better student. You'll probably like be more engaged. You might like your university
yeah.
more.
Yeah.
That's not exactly empowered. That's an empowered student move.
Yeah.
But like those are the same kinds of things you could do in terms of being involved in a city council race mm-hmm. or, you know, even yard signs. I mean, they're very small things, but displaying your principles and acting on them, is increasingly hard in some ways in our society. You know, it's mm-hmm. it's much easier to hide those things, what you
sure.
believe in, what you care about. And a lot of incentives align for you to do that.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I think that's an important part of why we weren't just focusing on citizenship.
Yep.
We're focusing on empowered
mm-hmm.
citizenship. And it's those things
yeah.
that make us feel more empowered, which is why we were really, our director Megan really led the way for putting mm-hmm. those intentional words together for our theme. So thank you for your reflections on that. My last question for you is the way I always end every podcast, which is kind of funny. We already kind of talked about it a little bit, but I always ask, like, what advice would you give for somebody wanting to kind of follow a similar career path as you? So you did get a PhD and you did go into being a professor. What advice would you give?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think in the greater scheme of things, when I look back on the successes I've had and the path that I've traveled, luck has been a big part of it. And so I emphasize some humility in the face of what is unknown moving
yeah.
forward.
Yeah.
You know, I was saying to Kayler Sweeney earlier, being an academic for a lot of us, if you're fortunate enough to have a position, means living like the military. You go where you are, where you get a good job, where you're assigned, that kind
yeah.
of thing. And you may move multiple times. Some folks don't, but I've been on the East Coast, I've been on the West Coast, now I'm in the Midwest. You uproot your family, like all kinds of things can happen. So that's mm-hmm. one element of that. You know, I think I can't imagine anyone would follow my model of knowing that they're passionate about history in fourth grade. There's very few people who had an amazing teacher and then acted on that and then got fortunate enough to do college and go to grad school. But I guess I would say, you know, for a PhD in history, a PhD in the humanities, it's an amazing path if you know what you're getting into.
Okay.
You get to read and think, you know, with smart people, the cohort experience, the research, working with faculty, it's fantastic. If that's the kind of thing you're interested in, regardless of what the next steps are for your career, mm-hmm. it's worth thinking about.
Yeah.
If you really only want to be a professor, it's a hard career because the job market is just so terrible.
Yeah.
And then the other piece, now this is just gloomy and we probably shouldn't end on this, but higher ed in this country is really under fire.
Yep.
And I think about it all the time, advocating for history and the humanities. You know, I've only been in Ohio a short time. I've already testified multiple times in the state Senate,
mm-hmm.
you know, trying to push back against overreach and regulation of higher education.
Yep.
You know, so I would love to have more great people involved in higher ed and advocating for it. Maybe those people who get PhDs or get advanced degrees of any kind will help us just make a stronger case for why education matters, why it should be better funded, not just to fund my salary or things going on at a center, but rather think about student debt and other elements.
Yeah.
You know, we build a lot of new buildings on campuses and a lot of them are purposeful and great, but wouldn't it be just as good if we could eliminate student debt, you know, have more people taking the majors that they want.
Yeah,
not thinking,
have it make it more accessible.
Totally.
Yeah.
And, you know, it won't be for everyone. That's fine. You know, only something like 33% of Americans have four-year college degrees. Mm-hmm. But, you know, having that as an option, even later in life, I've had lots of non-traditional students coming back to school
in
their 30s and their 40s and their 50s, or people auditing and then taking grad classes in their 60s. Like, it's a great life. Like, people who care about those things and want to think about deeply about history, humanities, foreign relations, like, that is fantastic. If you only have a narrow kind of career path that you want to pursue, it's may not be for you because it's so hard to pull off. I don't think I fully appreciated that when I went to grad school, and that's why I keep hitting on it, why it's in my statement on my website. You know, I just want people to go in totally clear-eyed. Mm-hmm. It can be great, and there are lots of career options, but there are also some limitations. And I think, and again, thinking about the higher education today, like, we really do need more people advocating for higher ed. So, you know, part of thinking about following a path in, mm-hmm. in higher ed is thinking about, you know, what are the many ways that we can make a case in the U.S. to keep having arguably, if not definitively, the best higher education in the world, for all sure. in one country. We are diminishing that, each state, by not funding, and the way a lot of people talk about these things. I wouldn't be surprised if at the event tonight, somebody in some way, even the people coming out for these kinds of great events, mm-hmm. in my experience, will diminish, you know, some ways of understanding the world that come yeah. through liberal arts knowledge, for instance. And masters, you can go into communications, you can go into running a center or an institute mm-hmm. or being part of that programming. There's a lot of ways to make a big difference in higher ed, slightly aside from or adjacent to the teaching mission or the mentoring mission.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, I loved it. I loved that piece. We talk a lot. I mean, we work at a higher education, you know, institute. So we talk a lot about that, just the accessibility and making it a priority for, you know, in politics and whatnot. So that's great. Thank you so much for everything you've said in this podcast. It's been really fun.
Yeah, it's been fun having a conversation with
yeah.
you.
Yeah. And for those of you listening, Chris is a part of a panel that we are doing tonight. So by the time that you're listening to this podcast, the event will have already happened. But no fret, you can go and listen to it either on as a podcast on the Howland Science Center collection, The Rewind. I'll have it posted on there. But we also have a nice YouTube video if you'd like to watch the video of it. So you can see that, and also links to Chris's fellow panelists. They also did some off the stage podcast episodes. So all of that can be found at gvsu.edu/hc/globalcitizenship, which will be linked in the description below. But thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you for listening to Off the Stage Podcast, a series produced by the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University. The Hauenstein Center, inspired by Ralph Hauenstein's life of leadership and service, is dedicated to raising a community of ethical, effective leaders for the 21st century. For more information on our center, our Cook Leadership Academy, or our Common Ground Initiative, visit our website at www.gvsu.edu/hc. To keep up with our current events and reoccurring initiatives, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn, all of which can be found linked below. If you liked this episode, consider giving us a review or rating so we can be found by other podcast listeners. Again, thanks for listening to Off the Stage Podcast.